This could have been an email.
This could have been a message in a pneumatic tube. Go on.
What is the point of having a pneumatic tube system if we don't?
So I've been on holiday.
Yeah, how was that?
It was good. I got in the sea. Got in the fucking sea.
Get in the fucking sea. Was it cold?
It was. It was fucking freezing. My mum does wild swimming. She does. Yeah. She goes into the sea every morning for health and vigour. And she seemed so taken with the idea that I might join her for once, because I was coming earlier in the year than October, November, that I did twice. I did not swim properly, but I got very attacked by waves.
Good.
And so got properly soaked. Yeah, it was invigorating. I would not recommend it.
Were you full of vim?
Some vim. I think adrenaline from fearing for my life, possibly. And, you know, I say this as somebody who grew up swimming in the sea. I like swimming in the sea when it's warm. It's just when it's cold and there's waves crashing over your head, there's a lot for a body to take, especially when said body is not used to trials by ocean. But no, it was quite, you do feel pretty good afterwards. It's the same thing. It's the same kind of idea as a cold shower, I guess, isn't it? It gets your blood in all places.
Those ice plunge things where you sit in a sauna and then you go and jump in the ice. And
yeah, I did that once. That's bad.
Yeah.
Not actually in the ice.
No. Yeah. I can't see myself enjoying it on the basis that I hate saunas.
Yeah, I didn't even get in the sauna after being in the sea, I must say. I got in the jacuzzi for a bit, but I used to like saunas when I was a teenager. I think I was a bit of a lizard as a teenager, and I've slowly...
That makes sense.
...slowly transformed into a more mammalian, still, you know, like house cat level of wanting to be curled up in the warm, but...
Yeah, that's fair.
No longer requiring a heat lamp.
I like curling up in the warm, but saunas are too much for me. Mm. I think they give me horrible kitchen flashbacks.
Yeah, especially when people keep ringing bells and like insisting you take plates of food everywhere. It's weird sauna in Bury.
Maybe we just keep going to a restaurant. Yeah. For legal reasons, listeners, I must clarify that I have never been naked in a restaurant.
Well, certainly nothing that I'd tell anyone about.
Because that would be a violation of the food hygiene rules, Francine.
Indeed. I should probably warn listeners now that this podcast is going to come to you pretty much unedited, because I have no time to edit it. It's being recorded and released on Monday night.
Excellent. I'm so proud of us.
Mm-hmm. And that's because of the sea.
It is mostly because of the
that's
sea.
That's my excuse, and I'm sticking to it. Did you have a nice time Sunday?
I did have a nice time Sunday. We were going to try and record Sunday, so this would come out in time, because you were technically back from your holiday. And then I didn't want to be the one to say, could we do Monday instead? Because I want to go and have a little day out. But I did. And you were up for it. So sorry, listeners.
I was more than happy to hear it. Gave me a bit more time to look into postal avatars. So,
excellent.
Mm-hmm, yeah,
that's what we all need to look at in our day to day. And nice time. I went to a little steampunk day at the Museum of Power, which, what a fucking name.
Museum of Power.
Yeah, there's a little steam museum. It's very over in Maldon. It's very similar to like Bressingham, that sort of thing.
Okay.
There was even a little train you could ride around on. And it was that sort of borderline between this is fun and this is incredibly cringe. Like tea dueling and that sort of thing. Hmm? They get two people up on stage and they have to dunk a biscuit and then see whose biscuit doesn't break off the longest.
I get it now you've explained it to me. I'm still baffled that you said it and thought I'd know what you meant.
It is often done at these sorts of steampunk things, but there wasn't any like live music or anything to go along with that. So we just looked at stalls.
Just silent biscuit dunking. Oh my God. Oh my God. We have to do that next time we get coffee. Our friend will be appalled.
We'll have to ask him to adjudicate. I was also slightly put off by the one stall that was selling hats and then had in a little case of bits and bobs a yo-yo with a swastika on it.
Yeah. It's not ideal.
Just don't sell shit with swastikas on, I feel.
No. Did you listen to the latest Behind the Bastards? Not quite latest, but the history of the swastika?
No, I didn't. I'm super behind on that because I've been listening to Star Wars things.
I mean, this is obviously no excuse to be selling anything with a swastika on it at a steampunk rally. However, it probably, interestingly, came from not a Nazi originally.
I know the origins of the swastika are not with Nazis, but this also had the SS logo on the other side. Well,
that's probably
this
that
was
one,
a Nazi swastika on a yo-yo.
Yeah, I know you know the origin, but it's interesting to note that just before the Nazis rose to power, it was also just like a real like pop culture thing in American knickknacks and that. It was really weird.
I can imagine that.
Yeah.
But yeah. No, this was a Nazi yo-yo, which of all the things to be Nazi.
A yo-yo, yeah.
Yeah, it was a
more like, yo, no.
Oh, Francie.
Oh, fuck, I wish I was editing this.
But I did acquire a vintage RAF dress uniform.
And it looks fantastic.
It does. It needs a few tweaks because it's from the 1950s, so it's a little bit raggedy in places.
Will you post it in the Discord?
I will post a picture of it in the Discord, yeah. Nice. And also, it doesn't quite fit me.
Looks good, though.
It does.
I never wear clothes that fit, so that's fine.
I don't mind clothes that are too big. It's quite snug on the waist. I actually bought it on the basis that the trousers absolutely weren't going to fit. They were going to be too small, and I'd be cannibalising them for fabric, and then was pleasantly surprised to find I can just about do them up. But I need to let the waist out a tiny bit and possibly replace the button fly with a zip just on the basis that there's only so much fumbling I'm willing to do when I need to pee.
I say.
Darling.
Fumbling. Oh, no.
But yes, I'm quite pleased with that purchase.
Yeah, I'm glad.
And shall feel very dapper.
My one purchase of the week is bringing back some Jersey fudge for the office.
Excellent.
Yeah, it's expensive now. Cost of living in this economy, etc.
Or even essentials such as Jersey fudge.
Even essentials such as Jersey fudge, yes. Absolutely appalling.
I have to say, I'm not a big fudge fan.
I'm not really, no. Sticks to your teeth too much.
It's too sweet. Also, I think I've been given it as a souvenir too many times. Mm. And then, you know, you don't really fancy it and it's just kind of there. And then you've got this fudge like on the counter judging you.
Yeah, judgy fudge.
Judgy fudge. Yeah. Oh, no, that one was bad. That was worse than the yo-no, Francine.
Look, I'm trying.
I'm not blaming
I've been
you.
To the, apart from the dentist, I haven't talked to anybody today, so I'm just kind of revving up here.
Does that make me like your verbal fluffer? Title of your
sex
tape.
That's so much worse than anything I said.
I know, I'm just trying to make us both on the same level.
Mm-hmm, that's fair. Yeah. Drag yourself down to my level. Much better idea. It'll be quicker than trying to get me to anywhere sensible.
Don't try and come all the way up to these lofty heights. I've done nothing good. On that note, do you want to make a podcast?
Yes, I do. I do want to make a podcast. I do.
Hello and welcome to The True Shall Make You Fret, a podcast in which we are reading and recapping every book from Terry Pratchett's Discworld series, one at a time in chronological order. I'm Joanna Hagen.
And I'm Francine Carroll.
And this is the final part of our discussion of Going Postal.
The post is gone.
Everywhere, up in flames.
Oh, God.
Note on spoilers before we crack on. We are a spoiler-light podcast, obviously heavy spoilers for the book Going Postal, but we will avoid spoiling any major future events of the Discworld series, and we're saving any and all discussion of the final Discworld novel, The Shepherd's Crown, until we get there so you, dear listener, can come on the journey with us.
On a stagecoach headed to Genua, protected by four men with crowbars.
Need more men with crowbars on our podcast.
Yeah. Got our buckets and spades.
Beautiful. Follow up. Things to follow up on.
Follow up. We have some. I have some, certainly. So in the Discord, Pete Jordan, a regular correspondent, said that he was surprised we'd not mentioned the Horizon or Fujitsu, or derisory gestures of folk and sensation by people derailing any possibility of taking responsibility for their own actions sort of thing, which, for anyone who's not familiar with the Horizon scandal, may be absolute nonsense. So I will explain. This is something I wasn't going to go into because it's not quite as relevant as I'd want, and it does make me very cross. But I will try and very briefly summarise it, and then I'll link to a fantastic special report from Private Eye, which they very kindly made sans
just
paywall.
For us.
Yeah, just for us. Pages and pages, it's amazing. Do you know much about this before I...
No, I haven't been reading up on it.
Cool. So, 1999, the Post Office, which was still part of Royal Mail at the time, rolled out accounting software called Horizon, developed by Japanese firm Fujitsu. Right from the off, sub-postmasters, which are individuals who run the post office branches, started reporting that the new software was dodgy. There were discrepancies in the accounts and money was straight up missing and they couldn't explain it. However, the post office, instead of perhaps trusting their trustworthy employees, insisted that Horizon was robust and refused to publicly accept the possibility that it had caused any discrepancies. Privately, higher-ups in both Fujitsu and the post office knew that Horizon was littered with bugs. That's quite important. As they had no support or even a good faith audience to appeal to, sub-postmasters scrambled to cover these losses themselves. We're talking thousands of pounds here, tens of thousands in some cases. And so some of them couldn't or wouldn't. And the post office started prosecuting them for theft, for fraud, and or for false accounting. Fun fact, the post office is pretty much unique in that it can bring private prosecutions thanks to historical and now, frankly, defunct necessity. Just side note, it's fucking insane that the victim in this case is allowed to bring the prosecution. And victim, obviously, in scare quotes there, the party that perceives itself as the victim is allowed to bring prosecution. Absolutely fucking insane. Anyway, they managed 918 successful prosecutions between 1991 and 2015, despite a marked lack of evidence. Once they had a criminal prosecution, the post office would then press on and through various other legal nonsenses seized assets from the prosecuted parties. These tactics caused false imprisonment, divorce, ill health, and at least one suicide. Here's a link to the episode, to the podcast episode. I'm referring here to Martin Griffiths, who took his own life in 2013 after being unjustifiably slung on the hook for tens of thousands of pounds. His successor was not told what had happened to him.
Jesus.
And he was eventually also suspended and ordered to pay thousands after further Horizon fuckery. This story goes on and fucking on, and the more layers you peel back, the more infuriating it gets. The affected sub-postmasters weren't told about the rest of the cases. They were deliberately kept in the dark here. So they thought they were on their own. They were isolated. There was nothing they could fucking do. It terrifies me. The post office changed guidelines to make disputing the discrepancies basically impossible. It's one of the biggest, or certainly the most widespread, miscarriages of justice in British history. Again, I will link to a proper report in the show notes because we could talk about this for fucking hours and nobody wants that apart from me. So I'll link to the private eye thing, but that basically, I hope you're happy, Pete. But you were right. It probably did bear mentioning. Also, the some postmasters, a lot of them have sued the post office now. There has been, this post office has done everything they can to fucking block any kind of justice here. They've lied to fucking MPs about this. They've lied to any authorities, looked into it. There's finally some compensation being offered. It's a whole thing. I'll link to a news story as well because it's updated fairly recently.
It is fucking appalling and atrocious and horrific.
It is. All of those things. Do you have a less appalling, atrocious and horrific follow-up to heighten the tone slightly?
On a lighter note, because we always believe things should end on a lighter note. Thank you, Mr. DeWitt.
The end of the beginning.
First, we've been reassured by multiple sources that chips are in fact reheatable, shallow frying and air fryer seem the most popular options. Personally, I won't be indulging in this air fryer nonsense.
My uncle's got one. Just been on holiday with the family. I've heard a lot about air fryers.
I mean,
he's genuinely delighted, but everybody who gets one seems to be genuinely delighted. And at this point, I'm just worried it's a cult item.
I am 99% sure it's a cult.
Yeah, yeah.
But the business will go under soon. It'll do what Instant Pot did. Yeah. Because they are like Instant Pot, there's no way to build in obsolescence with a product like that. So once everyone gets their air fryer, the business has nothing else to fucking do.
And constant growth instead of just steady profit is necessary in the modern... Sorry, don't start me off on capitalism again.
Anyway, okay, less capitalistic. We got an email from Claudia. Hi, Claudia. There's a probably apocryphal anecdote from German history that's relevant to the current book. Yeah. In 1933, Paul von Hindenburg was German head of state and his portrait was on many stamps. When a certain Mr. Hitler was gaining power in Parliament, Hindenburg refused to appoint him Chancellor. According to legend, he said, "The only position I'd give him is Postmaster General, then he can lick me from behind," the German equivalent of kiss my ass.
It's not sure, a lot more graphic, isn't it?
Yeah. Chloe said she's not sure how true the story is, but it's famous enough. My history teacher once quoted it in class, and it's likely that Pratchett also knew it.
Fantastic. I love that.
So on that note, should we talk about the book Going Postal?
Yes. Let's.
Now that we're half an hour into the episode. Sure. Francine, what happened previously on Going Postal?
Previously on Going Postal. Crispin Horsefry panics, but not for long. Reach Gilt's special contractor brings such unpleasantries screeching to a halt. Meanwhile, Lipvig survives a mail slide, stumbles through the postman's walk, receives his golden hat, and ascends into avatarism, propelled on wings of paper and ink. The morning after, he must make good on the promises made in his mercurial rhapsody, so he sends out his shiny buttoned postman and post golems, before delighting Stanley with stamps. And now it's time to raise the stakes, and Moist joins Boris in biting the horizon en route to Stolat with a post sack. He has won the hearts of Ankh Morpork, but further provoked Reacher Gilt. And so, during his dinner with Adora, the Postmaster General smells smoke on the air.
Ooh.
Ooh. Ooh.
So in this section...
Don't we usually do helicopters and loincloths before now?
No.
No, it's afterwards. Every time. I can't do this. What's wrong with me? Please.
The episode plan is, it should be in front of you.
I know. Well, it's a different page in my notes these days, you see, because I've got Obsidian. Sorry.
In this section, which begins in chapter 10 and goes all the way to the end, we've not saved the epilogue for a separate episode. In chapter 10, the letters burn and Stanley follows the rules. Moist heroically rescues Stanley and Groat, who's a bit worse for wear, as the post office burns. Of course, he has to go back for the cat, currently under the sorting engine, and comes face to face with Grile, who meets an unfortunate end and physics-defying end. Meanwhile, the golems fight the fire, but cold water hits a glowing hot Angamarad who goes to sit in the black sands. F5. Rain falls and Moist thinks about rebuilding from the ashes. He remembers Albert Spangler's money and just needs some divine intervention. As he dances with Adora, he promises to take down Gilt. Early in the morning, Moist sends a letter to Offler and other gods and gets the mail moving. The Gnus for Pseudopolis warning is on his mind. Miss McAllaria sobs, the clacks go down, and Moist announces a mail run before stepping into the light and hearing the gods. Chapter 11, in Vetinari's office, we get a handy rundown of events in the space between chapters. There has been a riot at the Clack's office. Moist followed the gods to bury gold. Moist goes to visit Groat in hospital and gets him and his strange syrup discharged.
Riot at the post office. Sorry. Clack's office. Fuck.
No panicking at discos on this podcast, Francine. The Grand Trunk's board are concerned, and Pony explains why maintenance might be an issue. Reacher's not panicking, he suggests finding some funds, and he makes a deal with Pony and heads to the Times. Late at night, letters arrive for Moist, and an early edition of the Times featuring Reacher's best corporate nonsense leads to some effusive swearing. Adora shares her history with Crooks, and Moist makes a plan to attempt the impossible. In Chapter 12, Vetinari visits Moist, who's challenged the Clacks in a race to Genua. Moist has 8-1 odds on, but Gilt's making plans. Pony outlines procedures to protect against sabotage, and Moist tells Adora he's out of ideas. He wants her help and tells her the whole truth. In return, she sends him to the roof. Up in the sky, Moist's prayers are answered by the smoking Gnu. They've got an idea to take out all the towers. Chapter 13, Ridcully plays pool and picks a book. Moist dreams about the trunk burning and wants to change the message instead of wreaking havoc. He's got a plan to wreck Gilt. He grabs some paperwork from Adora and shows up late to the starting line with a broomstick in hand. After a personal bet with Gilt, he makes a proposal and rides out on the mail coach. Moist stops at the tower and tells the Gnu to drop the woodpecker. They'll be killing with words. After intercepting with his own message, he heads back to the city to slip into the Omniscope audience just in time to see Collarbone get a clax from the dead. In Chapter 14, uproar abounds. Vetinari calls for a vast audit. The towers light back up. Gilt's gone missing and the board's been detained. Moist has won and he's got a lot to do. Pump gets a new job and a cockatoo is delivered. Vetinari watches the audit as the city gets saved by the fantasy of gold. Finally, in the epilogue, Gilt declines an angel.
Oh.
So, helicopter and loincloth watch. Mm-hmm. Helicopter goes to Moist's not airborne broomstick because never know, it could have done.
Yeah, absolutely. I like to think it was delivered to Nanny Og somewhere en route to...
I hope so.
Yeah. Oh, wait, no, it got taken off. Whatever.
She'll come across it. Yeah. As far as loincloths go, I'm giving the honour to Miss McAllariot's handkerchiefs.
Very good. Very good, very nice.
Which is also what I'm naming my coffee shop. No, I'm not. and just also for bits we keep track of, we are currently in the century of the anchovy.
Oh, good to know.
I do like
it. Nice to know you can make a savoury sauce with your...
with your century. What's your favourite quote, Francine?
My favourite quote, Joanna. I think we've both gone poetic this time, haven't we?
Mm-hmm.
But what was happening now? This was magical. Ordinary men had dreamed it up and put it together, building towers on rafts in swamps and across the frozen spines of mountains. They'd cursed and, worse, used logarithms. They'd waded through rivers and dabbled in trigonometry. They hadn't dreamed in the way that people usually use the word, but they'd imagined a different world and bent metal round it. And out of all the sweat and swearing and mathematics had come this thing, dropping words across the world as softly as starlight.
I love that bit.
Yeah.
It's beautiful.
It is.
Mine is, I think, just a little bit later.
Yeah.
Silence, said Vetinari. It wasn't a very loud word, but it had an effect rather like that of a drop of black ink in a glass of clear water. The word spread out in coils and tendrils, getting everywhere. It strangled the noise.
Ultimate simile.
Fantastic simile. And a nice... because it's Vetinari, it's definitely a bit of tincture infusing the soup of the afternoon.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Tincture, strongly implied.
Tincture, always strongly implied, I feel, where Vetinari is concerned. Characters.
Yeah, got a few of them.
Yeah, we have. Let's start with Moist.
We'll try and rattle.
Let's rattle. He's having a day. A couple of days.
Yeah, I didn't keep track of how much he slept, but I think it wasn't enough, although possibly not quite down to Vimes's levels in Nightwatch.
Yeah. He definitely does need to sleep. Or failing that, some Clachian coffee.
Yeah. Oh, God. Can you imagine?
I don't want to imagine a nerd Moist.
But yeah, so Moist von Lipwig, redemption arc supreme.
Love the redemption arc. Again, I love the fighting the redemption arc every step of the way and being redeemed anyway. I think it kind of follows on from what I was talking about with him last week. When he's going in, he had to find the cat, because if he didn't, it wouldn't be fun anymore. If he didn't risk at least a tiny bit of life and a smidgen of limb, he just wouldn't be able to carry on being him.
Mm-hmm.
Which he thinks to himself and then immediately thinks to himself, God, what am I on about? Why did no one tell me not to be like this?
Yeah. Oh, man. So my main point about Moist von Lipwig, really, is the cleverness of the perspective of having his inner narrative without giving away the plan.
Yeah.
And I don't know if this is something you wanted to go into in your talking point.
We can talk about this.
Okay, cool. But yeah, just because I know perspective is something you like to look at. And I think this is just we talked about in previous episodes how his kind of blackouts for the Avatar interludes were quite a clever way of keeping us slightly in the dark, or at least fast forwarding through some of the nonsense. But when they're talking about the plan that won't work, the coach on the way to January, Moist knows he's not going to win, but we don't know how he knows. All we know is that, and just having like a very slight insight into his mind without all the inner workings, I think is very clever, if understated, way of writing first person.
Yeah.
Third person, but with narrative.
Yes. Person-centric third person, something like that.
Yeah, that sounds right, sure.
It's the way it sort of goes off into montages when he proposes plans to the smoking gnu, and it automatically steps away a little bit.
Yeah.
It's really cleverly done.
Yeah. Yeah. And it keeps the pace perfect. Like, we know something's happening. We don't know what, but it doesn't, like, smoke and mirrors it all. It just says, you'll find out in a minute.
No. And, obviously we're going to save talking about the TV adaptation for the... we're going to do that at Christmas instead of now. So we don't get the scene where he finds the buried gold in this, and we do in the TV adaptation. And it's actually one of my favourite scenes in it, because it works. Okay. It works visually. It's fun. And
yeah,
it doesn't need to be here. veterinary summing up events works better.
Exactly. I love that. Yeah, you get this kind of impassive, and here's what you did. Do you recall?
And it works because he's pretending he doesn't remember being possessed by the gods as such.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, he's definitely, he's got the kind of the vimes allowing veterinary to stare through your head thing down.
Yes.
It didn't take him as long to pick up.
I love his frustration in this bit as well. He's just, he dances and enjoys this idea of bringing the post office back from the ashes because he's had this idea. But then he finds out everyone's betting on him for the race. And he's just like, I need you to believe that I can't, it's not physically possible. It's a 2-week coach drive and everyone's just sort of winking at him and tapping their nose and...
Yeah, and the more honest he's being about being a crook, the more people are believing him. And that's what kind of he's always, well, that's what reach of guilt certainly has always relied on. And
yeah.
And he gets the same thing when he's talking to Adora, doesn't he?
Yeah, a little bit. And this is a con coming back to haunt him, which is slowly happening more and more as he gets redeemed throughout the book. And I think this is it. This is the quickest a con has come back to haunt him.
Yeah.
He's lied about being able to do something and immediately seeing the consequences of it.
Mm.
But I do love when he does his big reveal to Adora. A, he says, I think I've fallen into good ways. And B, he says, I'm not reach of guilt. That's important.
Mm-hmm.
It's like a golem not being a hammer.
Yes. Yes. I am a con man.
But I'm not that.
I am human. Yes, I have a conscience.
And he gets... his last moments not in the golden suit before the big end game of the book, he's lonely. He didn't want to be a person you forgot, someone who was one step above a shadow. That I think that's almost, it's a really quiet moment, but it's one of his biggest redemption things. He doesn't want to be a face in the crowd anymore, partly because he loves what he can do as the man in the golden suit.
Yeah.
And partly because he is more than just the con man who was just a face in the crowd.
Yeah. Who is it he's talking to when he has that flash of, you know, the crossroads of
Adora.
It is Adora, is it? Yeah, here's my possible future life. That's another bit of that, isn't it? It's the...
Yeah, it's just after Mr. Pump has said that he's got a new job, and so Moist realises he's without a parole officer, and Adora goes to take his hand, and he thinks about just quickly running away, and then realises how lonely it'll be, and he dances with Adora.
Yeah.
It's a beautiful moment. I love it.
Yeah. Speaking of Adora.
Yeah, let's talk about Adora. What did you think about her whole, the backstory bit where she was screwed over by Moist and working at a bank?
Hurriedly gone through. I it was an interesting one. It almost seemed like they needed to, Pratchett was giving her something to forgive him for.
It felt it forced Moist to really come face to face with something in a way that Mr. Point didn't, and she compares this unknown con man to guilt and that.
Yeah.
From that side it worked, but yeah, it fits in, it feels a little bit shoehorned in.
It does a little bit. It didn't like snag at the time, but looking back over the notes, I was like, oh, I kind of thought that would come up again, but yeah.
Yeah, especially also with the time frame of when they were really wealthy and she had her pony and then when her dad lost his business and where it falls in that. If they were living in the city and they were wealthy, why did she go and work in a little bank in Stolat? And
I kind of assumed it was such an inconsequential bit in her life that it didn't matter that much. Do you know what I mean? Wealthy girl goes and gets a summer job.
Yeah.
But it wasn't really explicitly.
Yeah, and she's kind of full of hatred towards the person that lost her the job because she compares them to guilt, so...
That's true. I'm full of hatred for all kinds of people who slightly wronged me in my past, though, as well.
Oh, yeah, that's fine. I'm full of hatred for anyone who's ever stopped on a pavement in front of me.
Yeah, and then she's given a pet name, and...
she's Spike.
The spikiest pet name.
I like it as a pet name.
Yeah, it's definitely stiletto-coded.
Okay, so Stanley, bless Stanley, just quickly, the way he follows the rules when the post office is on fire, and he gets out the instructions, shouts fire in a clear voice and ticks it off.
And then just sits down to die.
All avenues of further activity being therefore closed, Stanley remained calm.
Well, good for him. It is not often you can write remain calm and somebody will follow that.
True. Remain clam.
Remain clam. And, you know, it might have saved him. You start hyperventilating in smoke.
Oh, yeah.
Smoke it.
You don't want to hyperventilate in a burning building. Mm-mm. You heard it here first, folks.
Thumbs down to unnecessary smoke inhalation.
But the very
thumbs up to checklists.
He remains very calm until Moish shows up, and then he's allowed to panic a little bit. But he sort of does it in a, I think I had a little moment.
Yeah.
You sit with a bag of pins.
Wow, what a way to be randomly rebuffed as well. I love that. Mouth full of pins. Youch.
And then Groat, who, not a fan of medical care.
Oh my god, that whole bit was so fucking funny.
Concerned about women seeing his rattle and flute, or trumpet and skittles.
Oh, and yeah, during that bit we get the return of the double H, of course. What?
What? Run away from any woman who pronounces what with two H's. I just like as well Groat's idea of staying away from things like hygiene and being upset about having a bath. I feel like it's a cousin to the Granny Weatherwax school of I just wash bits as and when they become available.
Yeah, very sensible.
Which remains one of my favourite lines in Discworld overall.
While we're in the hospital, one of my favourite lines, Moist was sure doctors kept skeletons around to cow patients. Yeah, yeah, we know what you look like underneath.
And that was in Dr. Lorne's office, which, nice to see Dr. Lorne again. Glad he's doing well.
Oh, yeah.
But his Thriving. Absolute furious horror at Groat's health. It's like, I don't know how this is alive, but it is. Take it away.
Oh, fuck. This whole bit is just full of lovely little, like, just little one, like the fucking Dr. Lorne having a nameplate on his desk. Cause he's very busy. He can't remember everything. It's so funny.
It's
Pratchett just writing a little hospital sitcom scene.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just briefly delving into the Jeeves and Worcester world or the Monty Python and then stampeding back out with your poultice smoking.
Yeah, there's definitely like a Blackadder flavour to it.
Yeah, yeah.
And then Miss Iodine McLariat.
Ah, we now know.
Because my father liked the sound.
Now, I don't know if it's iodine or iodine, and I asked this the other day of my mum, and she told me, and I've forgotten again. One of them's American English and one's UK, so it's fine either way. But
I think I've always said it in my head as iodine.
Yeah, I like iodine. Let's stick with it.
I prefer iodine as a name for a girl.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
Lovely name for a girl.
Iodine sounds like it's had a syllable cut off and it should be iodina.
Yes, agreed. Yeah. Syllabectomy, terrible thing.
I love that, and we will talk about Anoia, but just a few pages after Anoia is introduced, Miss McAlary admits the whole family have been worshipping Anoia for years.
I kind of forgot this is where we first got all of that nonsense, and it's wonderful.
Yep. It's a great bit of Pratchett nonsense. And yes, Miss McAlary has been training for the post office her whole life. Her grandmother even made me practice sucking lemons to get the expression right. And this is where we get the brief. Do we embrace divertingly? I think you mean diversity. We don't say that we do, but we do it. Yeah. And she's got concerns about dwarfs.
She's got, yeah.
She does worry about the loos, does Miss Iodine McLariat?
Yeah, I feel like as long as she's consulted, you can pretty much do what you want. But she's, yeah. She feels like she should be concerned more than having any actual concerns.
Yes, it's a concern out of habit.
Yeah, which we do need to ferry more of the UK population kind of towards that instead of deciding they have concerns because the mail said so.
Right, I'm trying to gloss over it because I'll rant. Grile! Grile is revealed to be
you know what's
a banshee.
Better than a turf? A horrible swooping banshee.
I would pick a banshee over a turf any fucking day.
Hit the mouth with pins, sorry. Anyway, mouth with pins.
Yeah, winged.
Winged, swooped.
Eviscerated.
Crushed in the third dimension.
The further explanation, hearing the scream of the banshee meant you were going to die because it meant the banshee was tracking you.
Yeah, yeah. Very, very immediate.
So what I found interesting is on the Discworld, the Banshees sort of come uberworld by way of lush jungles, and they're kind of like a human flying squirrel.
Yeah.
But
reminds
violent.
Me of an Ai-Ai. Like the myths around Ai-Ai specifically, rather than the actual friendly, not friendly, but, you know, harmless little herbivore, omnivore, what's it? Yeah.
But yeah, in round world mythology, handily, I did this research already for a rabbit hole.
Yes, tell us about Banshees.
Banshees are of Celtic origin. Bansheed, woman of the Sheed, Sheed being like a fairy hill. I'm going to apologise for my Celtic pronunciations now because I can't do it. Mm-hmm. They sort of come from the same chunk of mythology as the Tawat Didanann, which is sort of a tribe of gods and a big part of the origins of Celtic fairy folklore. The Danann are associated with the Sheed, which are ancient burial grounds and apparently entrances to the underworld. So think sort of burial mounds, that kind of thing.
Yeah, cool.
And it's a whole big royalty structure. There's kings and queens and warriors and heroes and supernatural beings. And there's sort of this descendant of them into folklore, the Aeshid, the people of the mounds. And they're sort of... what's there after Tuat Didanann have gone back to their other world, as it were. Mm. And Aeshid, that mythology is the origins of things like leaving the milk out for the fairies. A lot of that comes from that. And along that you have the Bansheed, and this is the origin of the fairy myth. It was kind of tied to, like the Bansheed were tied to individual families, and they were all feminine, and they would start crying when, or keening when one of the family was going to die.
Very distracting.
Yeah. So if you were going to do like a more direct parallel, I guess they'd be bimbling around with the elves, part of that court. Mm.
Yeah.
So I like that it created a whole different mythology for them here.
Yeah, no, absolutely. He's played around with a lot of the Celtic stuff already, hasn't he?
Yeah, so it's nice to...
You're new!
Make something completely different.
Yeah. I went to a really cool burial mound in Jersey, by the way, 6,000 years old, Lahogby. I'll tell you about it later.
Oh, nice. Mm. And then our Angamarad.
Ah, fucking... Yeah. Here's the crying moment.
I forgot how little he was in the book. I remember reading this and always being upset at what happens to Angamarad, but he genuinely is only in like 2-3 scenes. And he's just so impactful.
He is, yeah. He kind of symbolizes. I don't know. His whole being is just, it seems completely permanent and then turned out to be completely impermanent. And
yeah, it just takes one very unfortunate combination.
Yeah, insane.
The opening bit of his, and this is where we get death in this book for those keeping score. The opening bit of his scene, flames died, sound died, light died. But then he chooses to stay in the desert.
Oh, I know. He doesn't want to do anything. He hasn't got another task. He's like, all right, fucking fantastic. Not going anywhere else. They'll give me another thing to do.
It is perfect. I am free.
Yeah. It's another reminder as well of how silly it is to try and understand the mind of a golem.
Yeah.
Because boredom is not a thing. And it's impossible to imagine that really as a human, isn't it? But
yeah, not even a little bit.
No, I'm going to sit here. This is fine. This is nice.
I get bored halfway through saying a sentence. Mm. That is mostly because it's me talking. on to happier, maybe. We've got a brief cameo from Carrot and Angua.
Mm.
And I really like when we do stuff like this. We had it a bit in The Truth and Monstrous Wrenchment as well. You get this kind of defamiliarization thing, like we know the characters, but the character whose perspective like doesn't know them. So we're like, so we can kind of do Leo pointing me, ah, it's friend. Mm-hmm. And the description of Carrot when he's interviewing Moist, his face gave nothing away that he didn't want to let go of.
Yes.
And then the werewolf winks at Moist as well.
Always a bit disconcerting coming from a canine. I thought it would have been quite in character for Moist to kind of greet the werewolf as a person, but then I suppose in case he's got it wrong.
Yeah.
Officer.
We don't want another Knobby Knobs moment. What I mean is that it's not always necessary to greet Knobby Knobs as human.
No, exactly, yeah.
And yeah, so this is our introduction to Anoia, a minor goddess of things that stick in drawers.
Rattle, rattle.
With her priestess, Miss Extramelia Mume.
Yes, what a name. We've got some fine ones in here. But that is by far the most filigreed, I would say.
It also occurs to me that Anoia is kind of a fun callback. It starts with a joke in Monstrous Regiment when they're in the kitchen and they're seeing if there's anything they can use to escape. And it's like, oh, I've got this weird thing.
Yeah.
Everyone's always got one at the back of the drawer. It's for edible dormouse stuffing or something.
Yeah, yeah.
So I like that this is kind of a carry on of that, of like, right, but what if that thing gets stuck?
Yes. And now what happens if she accidentally becomes one of the more prominent gods in Ankh-Morpork just because of like a random whim? Which does, yes, actually, that's a nice kind of reflection of how that works, isn't it? Kind of sometimes some of the more, especially in pantheistic religions, sometimes one of the gods will just rise to prominence because,
yeah,
was in favour that year. Snowballed. That's kind of become a Discworld meme, hasn't it?
Yeah.
Everybody latched onto that and rattled your drawers as like a cross fingers shorthand, yes, in the Discworld fan community, which is quite fun.
I enjoy it. And that was one of the lovely cross stitches we got from Ella, was a rattle your drawers cross stitch.
Ah, yes, it was. And we do.
And we do.
Not through piety, just because we're bad at putting stuff in drawers.
Yeah, no, there are bottle openers up the wazoo in that awkward little bit at the back. Anyway,
oh, no.
Bet Nari. Again, slight like defamiliarization. Moist doesn't know Vetinari as well as like we do, or like other characters we see interact with him. Like obviously we see Vimes and Vetinari, and they've been working together / bussing heads for so many books. So after Moist finds the money and Vetinari does the whole, and it seems to be X amount that Albert Spangler had, and maybe we should pay some tithes.
Yes, maybe we should.
And Boyce thinks, why is this man just ruling just one city? Why isn't he ruling the world?
I really loved that bit, actually, when he was just confirming that Moist was on board by saying, Albert Spangler. I was like, no, he's dead. Are you sure about that? Yep. I was there. Like, okay.
I was there when they hanged him.
In that case, let's move on. Oh, no, I like that we kind of reestablish his tyranny in this one.
He gets to do some actual tyranting.
I know. I like to think he enjoys it. He fucking swells a cloak.
His cloak swells dramatically, and someone says, on what charge? There doesn't have to be one.
Bit hot, isn't it? Let's be honest.
Yeah, no, a little bit. As recent, and as you know, I am not in any way pro fan casting, because it just takes over, like any fandom space just becomes, I think that Miriam Margolyes should play Nanny Ogg, but
Miriam Margolyes should play Vatna. No, sorry.
No, Giancarlo Esposito, and I'll send you some pictures.
Okay, thank you.
Should play Vetinari, and okay, I will die on that hill.
Okay. Feel free. Sorry, that was unnecessary.
It's a completely inconsequential hill to die on, and you know those are my favourite. Mr. Absolutely. Pony.
Wait, no, wait. One more Vetinari. Oh. I thought, while he was tyrannicising, I liked that he also showed his continued diplomacy, especially towards the wizards. And I thought it was particularly well illustrated when he goes, after his cloak swirling, Vetinari turns to Ridkeley, Arch-Chancellor, I would be grateful if you would instruct your student to continue, please, he said in the same calm tone. And this is after he's been bossing every important person in Ankh-Morpork about.
Yeah.
And he asks Ridkeley to ask his student. He's like, I'm going to respect your authority on this.
Yeah, that was a great moment. So, Mr. Pony.
Mr. Pony.
And his pink flimsies.
His pink flimsies, his Pony Express. Forgive me, Mr. Pony. As a little, it's a pony relay. There was a horse relay postal thing for anyone who's not into horse post.
And they also have like a horse relay set up all the clax towers in case things go wrong. He's an incredibly like well realized three dimensional character for someone who's introduced in the last third of the book.
Absolutely, he's possibly ill advisedly stayed on, but he's trying his best.
Yeah.
And I think if you've ever worked somewhere that's understaffed and really does need some fucking health and safety, there's usually someone like this around clutching a fistful of pink flimsies, which, by the way, are like carbon copy paper.
Yeah.
For anyone who doesn't have to do those a lot. So it's basically a record of whatever you've written to somebody else or whatever form you've signed or whatever somebody else has signed. It's a paper trail.
Which is a useful thing to have.
It is.
But his inner monologue has this like sort of simmering rage. If they don't polish a chair with their arse all day, you think a man who's done a 7-year apprenticeship is the same as some twerp who can't be trusted to hold a hammer.
Yeah. And his inner monologue is starting to become an outer monologue by the time.
Well, he finally loses it with the board and they sort of go, that's impossible. Well, how do you know so much?
Yes.
Have you taken a differential drum apart with a tin opener? Hoomst among us, I say. Hoomst among us.
Hoomst, indeed. Oh, no. Who's next?
Reacher Guilt.
Reacher Guilt. Ah, this prick. Yeah.
Yeah, a bit of a wanker. I'd like, as he's speaking to the board, it occurred to one or two that the jovial my friends was beginning to sound like the word pal in the mouth of a man in an alley who was offering cosmetic surgery with a broken bottle.
Absolutely. And also the kind of metaphor of riding the tiger I always enjoy. And especially in this case, it's like, yeah, just that sudden realization that this is actually a fucking tiger.
Yeah.
And as such, will just eat you if no other option presents itself.
Unfortunately, however, I am on said tiger.
Mm-hmm.
The conversation he has with Pony, convincing him to do all the work for fuck all money.
Mm.
And the sort of, oh, and, you know, he was actually only getting a quarter of what he asked for, but ignoring that.
Yes.
And we'll talk more about some of his other corporate nonsense stuff, but it makes my skin crawl.
And the way he's described throughout, I mean, Guilt was being reasonable and statesmanlike, but his eye was a dark metal ball. And there was a harmonic of murder in his voice. And then he's really pisses off Litvig and says, it's Mr. Grotewell. And all of this way, all this kind of subtle manipulation, it works on Pony and on Litvig. I think Litvig sold himself short when he thought that Reacher Guilt was his superior in conmanship.
Yeah.
Because well, you have Litvig the moment outduels him and wins.
You have the moment where he starts to crack when he sees Moisture's brought the broomstick and is sort of this, that's how you were going to beat me.
Yeah.
Because he's still thinking of it in terms of winning the race.
Yes, absolutely.
Thinking about the third dimension of the 3D chess. I also just noticed there's the moment he just puts out the bear trap to see what will happen to Igor. And it's very like the thing that always gets used as like this kid's going to grow up to be a fucked up serial killer, whatever, is little boys pulling the wings off flies. It's very that.
It is very that, yeah.
Yeah, doing something just nasty just to see what will happen.
Yeah, just impassive.
We've
had a couple of characters like that before, haven't we? And it's definitely up there in the Pratchett lineup of effective villainy. He's kind of a crossover between that the horrible sociopath and the bureaucrat nightmare, isn't he?
But with a parrot, a cockatoo.
But with a parrot, yeah.
In the epilogue, he gets offered the Royal Mint. If he can, you know, do an Ambert Spangler to Moist von Litvig transformation. Obviously he doesn't take it.
No, but I wonder if it's very stupid.
I wonder if that'll come back to anyone. The smoking gnu.
It smoked. It gnued.
Mad Al, Sane Alex, and Adrian, who says he's not mad but can't prove it.
You need a certificate for this kind of thing.
We did learn the other day that Sane Alex is named after an actual fan / sort of acquaintance of Terry Pratchett's.
Nice.
Which is a marvellous thing. I like their insistence after they've introduced the woodpecker, which, you know, nice foreshadow. You need sort of more of a pause for effect, like the woodpecker.
The woodpecker. That's more like it.
Of course, if you said it in Uberwald, then a wolf would howl at just the right moment.
I know, there's fucking weather around here. It's got no sense of narrative imperative.
But yes, I think they're very sweet, and I like the moral argument that comes along with should we burn the clacks down or not, because there's a sense that they're young and they're not looking at big picture the way Moist is, and they're angry.
Yeah, absolutely. And if they can't see a way to get it back and therefore fuck it.
Yeah.
But yeah. But they are easily dissuaded from it, which is
good, yeah.
Important, yeah.
And then Rid Cully and the Wizards, my favourite band.
Oh, I always love it when Rid Cully pops up. I always forget he's going to be there.
I have great joy when Rid Cully pops up. I always feel sorry for Ponder at this point, for Rid Cully ignoring his whole explanation of Bay's space.
Mm-hmm.
Which is the most groan-worthy pun in the entire book, and I salute it.
It's very terrible. What do we think of the Grand Trunk? Bunch of bean crushers, I heard. Been killing people on those towers of theirs. Man, the pub told me he'd heard the ghosts of dead signalers haunt the trunk. I'll try for the pink.
It's nice of him to handily summarise what's been happening and who the good and bad guys are.
Yep, exposition via pool table. Perfect.
I like his reaction to the broomstick as well. He tells Moist that the stars wouldn't work and it never would have flown. Moist looked into a pair of milky blue eyes that were as innocent as a child's, particularly a child that is trying hard to look innocent.
Yes. As always, his wizard friends are wonderful. I like that we have a mollusk expert on the other end of the omniscope. Good man.
Devious,
with a whelk.
Devious Collarbone. Excellent name. Poor Dragon Breath Collarbone. Here's that damn enormous fiery eye again made me chuckle greatly.
Yes.
And it zooms out to become Collarbone.
The little bait and switch that you imagine Sauron, and then it turns out to be a hay feverish nerd.
And then he becomes Dr. Collarbone because Rid Cully was a great believer in retaliation by promotion.
Beautiful. We also have Mr. Pump.
I love his ending. He gets his new job and he says, I'm not certain what happiness is either, Mr. Litvig, but I think I am happy to have met you.
Yeah. He is a very good golem. He saves our Litvig in this section, doesn't he?
He does.
Everything fucking happens in this section. But yeah, he's a wonderful figure of a figure.
Good effort.
Fine figure of a figure.
And then quickly, copyright. Locations. Yes. I enjoy the brief visit to Dolly Sisters because this idea of that this still a bit villagey holds itself apart from the city, and have their own customs like Dog Turd Monday and Up Needles All.
Absolutely. Lovely little bit of Angmoreport lore.
Yes. And I'm curious about what Up Needles All is. I'm not sure I need to know about Dr. Ed Monday.
So. If anybody knows what the obscure reference is for Up Needles All,
answers
on a postcard, not on a dog turd, please.
Yeah, thank you.
I will say a quick university visit just because of the chutney, pickle and relish train needs a special mention.
Because one trolley wouldn't be enough.
Absolutely not.
I did notice, actually, the whole description of the meal felt a bit like a red wall on steroids.
Yes, yeah. Oh, and the wizards losing their patience for people at Salivar. What do you expect there to be at a fucking Salivar? Fracture just letting his frustration through there, I feel.
Yeah. And the buttresses of celery and cabbage. Yeah.
Oh my god, coleslaw. Just decide what you're gonna get.
No, that's fair.
Now I'm hungry.
I share the Salivar rage. Yeah, I'm quite peckish. Little bits we liked.
Ooh, things. Similes. Yes. I like similes. I like some more of them. Moist felt the acid rise in his throat until he could spit lacework in a sheet of steel, which I do know is a metaphor, but still.
Mm-hmm.
Poor Crispin came to see me the night before he died, said Gilt, as calmly as 6 inches of snow.
Oh, that's such a beautiful one.
Right? And then I'm going to shoehorn this in, even though it doesn't really, it is a simile, but I'm putting it in because, okay, so Princess went out onto the little platform to be out of the way. Underfoot, the snow was like icing sugar. In her nostrils, the air was like knives, which is good, but not one of my favourite similes. But I just wanted to mention it because, again, it's one of the little perspective bits that you like. We just get this really, like, brief stop into the perspective of Princess on one of the towers. And
yeah,
it's really effective and just really short. And I thought it was a really beautiful way to tie up that bit.
The visits to Tower 101, I think, are some of the best. Yeah. It's the one of the best devices in the book.
And it's such a change in perspective tone as well, because the couple of perspective shifts we get in this one are usually from like a man like a professional man to a professional man.
Yes.
And this one's just a little girl enjoying being in the snow on the tower. And one more. It was like looking for piranhas in a river choked with weeds. There were a lot of bones on the bottom, but although sometimes you thought you glimpsed a flash of silver, you can never be sure you'd seen a fish. The only way to be certain was to jump in.
Love that.
Danger. What do you think? What do you think about Ecumenical Matters?
Ecumenical Matters. Vesinari says, post the gods appearing to Moist, anyone even suggesting that the money was in some way obtained in the wrong fashion will have to argue with some very turbulent priests. And turbulent priest is a reference to, it was apparently said by Henry II, will no one rid me of this turbulent priest?
Right.
And then
I completely missed that.
Yep. And a group of his knights then went off to kill Thomas Becket of Canterbury.
Yeah. And depending on who you believed, Henry II didn't mean for that to happen.
Exactly.
It certainly didn't make him popular.
Gave him a way to hold his hands up of the bloody affair. And yes, this is something I entirely know about because of Blackadder Season 1.
Yeah. And fuck it. Why not? But
Oh, it's Brian Blessed saying it there, and it's very marvellously delivered.
It's hard to forget anything that Brian Blessed says. I thought you were going to talk about the sausages, the priests who cook the sausages. The smell goes up, and Moist briefly becomes a theologian. And he says, "We eat the mere earthly shell, which, believe me, turns to dust and ashes in our mouths." And Moist manages to get immediately aboard the train and goes, "Ah, yes, that explains why the smell of sausages is better than the sausage." And the priest was impressed. "Are you a theologian, sir?"
That was a great moment.
Oh, he's such a good PR spinner.
So corporate nonsense. This isn't so much something I like as a shared rant.
We like ranting about it.
Yeah,
we do. which bit particularly tickled your dispancy?
The note that Reacher does for the Times.
Mm-hmm.
"Spurred by the competition, we are investing several $100,000 in a challenging, relevant and exciting systemic overhaul of our entire organisation, focusing on our core competencies while maintaining full and listening cooperation with the communities we're proud to serve. We fully realise that our energetic attempts to mobilise the flawed infrastructure we have inherited have been less than totally satisfactory, and hope and trust that our valued and loyal customers will bear with us in the upcoming months as we interact synergistically with change management in our strive for excellence. That is our mission."
Probably being a whore from the start, that word.
Yeah, Moist response of, "You had to admire the way perfectly innocent words were mugged, ravished, stripped of all true meaning and decency, and then sent to walk the gutter for reaching guilt."
Oh, it's awful. I've spent too much of my life editing stuff like that to make it less like that.
Yeah.
I frequently fall into incoherent indignance when I'm reading the news and hear statements like that from the government in particular, because at this point I think we're all used to corporations doing it, but the government somehow is getting worse every fucking year with it. Yeah. And my poor long-suffering husband, I think at this point I've managed to reverse radicalise him, having radicalised him slightly. gotta wheel it back again. But fucking hell. Oh. Here we go. "No one was sorry for anything because no living creature had done anything wrong." It's the passive voice. The passive voice in headlines is fucking fantastic. And the media is, I'm going to sound very tinfoil for a second here. The media is complicit. But the media is often complicit by echoing these things and using passive language in a headline. So a person was killed in police shootout, not police shoots
killed
person. Yeah.
Yeah.
"Bad things had happened by spontaneous generation in some weird, chilly, geometric other world and were to be regretted."
Ugh. But for all that it's disgusting, Pratchett does it beautifully.
Oh, he does. He knows it. Oh, he used to work in nuclear power plant, didn't he?
Yeah.
He's done it. I like to think he was one of the people who took the copy and went, "Fuck, no." And rewrote it so it was at least a little honest. I'm going to assume he did. That's my headcanon. And the fucking, and it kind of melts into the points about health and safety because as Moist, I think, is reading it. He goes, through a pink mist. And I love the fact that Moist is so fucking infuriated by this, considering he's a con man and he hates this. This is like, oh, I don't know, a craftsman of any sort being just infuriated by trickery, isn't it? But safety is our foremost consideration. Why hadn't the lead type melted? Why hadn't the paper blazed rather than be part of this obscenity? The press should have buckled. The roller should have cleaved onto the... It's like, wow.
Which is great imagery when we had the actual burning press a few books ago.
That's a good point. Yeah. Ah.
And that
was
in a fight about publishing true things. And I do like to think the way this is presented in The Truth is, this is the statement, not, and therefore.
Yeah. And it's nice that Saturissa Cripslark is so not this.
Yeah, absolutely.
She posts the statement, but she'll also just straight up quote anyone who has the bad sense to talk to her.
Yes. I do like there's also just something that's a bit of a cousin to it when the Gnu are explaining the woodpecker to Moist. Moist risks the rest of the sentence. Innocent words swirled in it like debris caught in a flood.
Yes, the cousin to corporate nonsense, ineffectual jargon.
Yeah,
technobabble, yeah.
I'd be remiss if I didn't point out, I can't remember the name of it now, but Weird Al has a very funny song about this sort of corporate nonsense language. It's on Mandatory Fun album.
I can't remember the name of it either, but we'll link to it.
Yes.
Just make a note. Yeah. Fantastic. And it's just... The whole bit, again, I know I kind of went on a little bit of a rant about it in the first episode, so I won't again properly, but the whole thing about Pony's point about you are running it to death. We cannot do this. You can have one of, what is it? You can have one of three things. You can have cheap, effective, fast.
Yeah, you can have fast, cheap, or good.
Yeah. You can have one of those at this point. At some point, it might have been two. You can have one of those. And just the way that so many catastrophes happen is because of this kind of thing. One of my favourite subreddits, as some of us know, I don't go on it much anymore, I don't go on Reddit anymore much, but the Catastrophic Failure subreddit. And within that, Admiral Cloudberg's kind of very good breakdowns of air travel disasters.
Yeah.
And so many of these things, it's just like fucking little things build up and build up. And in this one, big things build up and build up. And people are treated like things. And that's what sin is.
Yes. Well done.
Yeah, one of those. Sorry. And there we go. I stopped my rant. Granny Weatherwax could always put a full stop on something for me.
Yes, she can. Granny. On a light note, there's a brief moment, and it's like the night after the post office is burned, and Moist is kind of just there existing. He's not sleeping, but he's around, and it's full of people. And in truth, there wasn't enough for everyone to do, but it was that kind of night. You had to be there, so later you could say, and I was there that very night.
Yeah, and you would be, I think.
Oh, yeah. 100%.
And that bit was when it was kind of the come down version of the quote I used about the ink and the sparks and things, which was something like the smell of wet paper just meant the end, didn't it? It was just this depressing smell. It's so true. Burnt wet paper. That's a smell.
That's something we haven't talked about much either, but the death of the old letters.
That's a good point. Yeah. What do you think of that as a narrative thing? So it's kind of this was the big driving force for the first two halves of the book. Yep, sure. thanks for all of you stupid Johnson.
From a narrative standpoint, they needed to get rid of those letters somehow because they could not physically post them all. And the idea is that the post office becomes a functioning entity.
Yeah. And it could have been like several books of the outcome of posting all these old letters. Yeah,
exactly. So I think they needed to be removed from the board in one fell swoop. And that was a good way. But just as a part of the story as well, there's something about it being a motivating factor for Moist. The dead letters were motivating him because they were talking to him. He had to deliver them because they almost forced a compulsion upon him when he was living among them.
Yes.
And so taking away that compulsion at that point, he could have walked away. And it's that moment where he realises he's got the money and he can do the Albert Spangler trick, and he asks Adora to dance. And there's this idea of ideas spinning like quicksilver is one of the lines.
Yes.
Is when Mercury. He stands still and the world flows around him. I think it's a good moment to really kickstart Moist into the full redemption bit of the arc.
Yeah, it's very Phoenix. I think he says something about Phoenix of a building, actually, doesn't he? But I think he's more of the Phoenix, really, just in the ashes in that moment. Yeah,
with his winged hat.
Beautiful.
Anyway. They used to happen.
Sorry. Yeah, we can't just go off into reveries today.
They used to happen before the semaphore.
Reveries, certainly. That's all we did. No. But Moyse kept thinking of all the bad things that could happen without the semaphore. Oh, they used to happen before the semaphore, of course, but that wasn't the same thing at all. And there's a really fucking huge point put in that, like, just snuck in there, I thought. Yeah. Which it set me off thinking, because I was reading this bit on a plane, and, you know, when you're landing or whatever, you've got a minute to think. I was thinking, that is such a good fucking point. There are so many things now that quite often bad things are excused by. We, you know, this is how it used to be, and we were fine. I was like, yeah, but now we've managed to fix this. So now this is a choice or a failing that has led to this. I've gone on about the Green Brothers quite a lot recently, but John Green's current... War Against Tuberculosis is quite an interesting one there, because he addressed the UN the other day. Mm-hmm. And as he said then, 75 or 100 years ago, we could say that X amount of people died of tuberculosis. But since we've had the cure, really, it is more accurate to say that a million odd people die every year through failings in human logistical or our choice not to get this medicine to the right people. And I think that's definitely how he's seeing that there, isn't it? It's like, if I take down the claques, everyone who dies because they don't have a message on time isn't dying because the claques aren't there. They're dying because we chose to take them down.
Yeah.
That's very big point. And I thought it was really cleverly and quickly made. Much more than mine.
I hadn't even really thought about it in that much depth, but you're absolutely right.
Well, it hit me just before landing, so...
That's the place to get hit by an idea.
Mm-hmm. But nothing else.
Hopefully.
Not a goose. And then going into some of your favourite visual metaphors.
I love the thing Pratchett does where people are looking down at something and they're circles.
Yay, you circles.
I'm not sure there's a word for it. I think I brought it up in every time it's come up before Nightwatch. I was like, I love this because it reminds me of this one bit I really like. And then we got to Nightwatch and it's this bit where they move the people and turn the circles green and pink. And and we get this sort of mental image of it here when the audit is happening. Mm. And Vetinari is physically looking down upon it in the Great Hall. And there's these chalked markings with papers and ledgers, and periodically they were added to piles, and then sometimes a new outline would fill and sometimes an outline would empty and the papers would be redistributed. And then the bankers turn up and bring papers, and then the watch have the red ledger, the one that Crispin gave Gilt, and that gets a circle and the pattern. I love the visual so much. It's so clever.
And imagine making such like an engaging and like visually engaging scene out of a massive audit.
Yeah.
Incredible.
Fantastic. And then you pointed out to me earlier today that sort of alongside that goes the huge floating crowd that was the street population of Ankh-Morpork ebbed and flowed around the city. And tonight it would contract to form a mob in the square and could be sold things, which is... very much the same flavour of thing, if not a circle.
Yeah, and I think that's another one from Nightwatch and maybe from some other books beforehand. But yeah, just a...
Yeah, Guards is like, I think, the beginning of the Ankh-Morpork floating mob. And it never really goes away.
Yes. Known for it.
Cool, let's talk about the bigger stuff then. I'll let you start.
Cool. So I just picked out some fun stuff about messenger avatars, messenger gods, because obviously that is what Moyse has become, an avatar of a messenger god. And the Discworld one, we can probably say is FedEx. I was about to say Forex. it's a slightly obscure Discworld reference because he only appears by name in Small Gods, where he sends a warning arrow. but he is an unnamed, I think, messenger god in this one.
Yeah.
And so I'll start this bit off, though, with a special mention, because he's probably not relevant here, but we love him. Ratatuska, the squirrel who scampers up and down the world tree Yggdrasil to carry messages between the canopy-dwelling eagles and the root-entwined serpent. And I think they're not very nice messages, if I recall. He appears in Neil Gaiman's American Gods, in which he brings Shadow a much-needed nutshell of water.
He does.
A little squirrel. A nice little squirrel, and we love him. And now, okay, onto the proper obvious one. So Moist Von Lipwig is quite obviously an avatar of Mercury. Oh, yeah. Hermes, if we're looking at the Greek, but I'd say closer to Mercury, just from what I've read. So how his power is described, how he's kind of floating on golden wings, whatever, he goes, he could feel that old electric feeling, the one you got deep inside when you stood there in front of a banker who was carefully examining an example of your very best work. And as you said earlier, these were the moments he lived for when he was really alive and his thoughts flowed like quicksilver and the very air sparkled. Later, that feeling would present its bill. Call back to magic. For yeah. Now, he flew. And quicksilver is obviously Mercury. It's another name for Mercury. Mm-hmm. And that would be just a nice visual metaphor anyway. But I think deliberately chosen in this point because Mercury is appropriate for Lipwig in more than one way. I mean, obviously, there's the visuals. Mercury or Hermes is represented as a young man with a winged hat, the petasos of Mercury, which is a traveling hat, but winged, and winged sandals. He also carried a white wand or a caduceus. I don't know how to pronounce that. But Mercury is not only a messenger, but a loquacious trickster. He's perfect. He's a patron of travellers, of shopkeepers, of merchants, rogues, vagabonds, and thieves. He's a very busy deity.
Yeah.
There's not only a lot of groups, a lot of very busy groups who need their god a lot, I would imagine.
Has he considered outsourcing to a lesser deity?
He probably has. But to be mercurial is to be light, to be quick and unpredictable, impossible to pin down. And so, you know, Moist makes the perfect avatar for Mercury. At one point, he thinks they'd made a crook the messenger of the gods, and he's all head in hand, self-pitying at the moment. But I think it was always thus. The crook was always the messenger of the gods. That's how it is. He's one of the trickster gods.
Yeah.
And then... just a couple of little bits about Mercury that I think suit this book. So posts with a marble head of Mercury were often placed at crossroads to show the way. Does that? I'm a little crossroads. We've got quite a few crossroads in here. Very tenuous link. Romans devoted to Mercury, the first fig gathered from a fig tree. And I know we talked about winged fig leaves before, and there are quite a lot of like ancient Roman depictions of phalluses, Greek maybe, of winged phalluses and things, which, you know, Google it yourselves. and little bit of foreshadowing, perhaps. Mercury is often sometimes depicted holding a purse.
Is he?
He is.
Goodness.
Now, this is a bit of a leap. It's just something I thought you'd enjoy and is kind of connected. Let's look at Fortunus, which is a German proto-novel about a legendary hero of the same name who's popular in the 15th and 16th centuries. And now, little nerd detail for Joanna. The plot of the novel appears in variants from oral tradition across Europe, Asia, Americas, and Africa, classified in the Arne Thompson Uther Index as tale type ATU 566, The Three Magic Objects and the Wonderful Fruits.
Yay!
yay, wonderful fruits. but fruit aside, the two magical objects in this tale, which may be relevant, are an endless purse and a wishing hat. The endless purse supplies endless wealth, and as you might expect, the wishing hat transports the wearer to wherever he desires. Now, Michael Haldane, who's a folklorist, wrote a very interesting article titled The Translation of the Unseen Self, Fortunus, Mercury and the Wishing Hat, which connects Mercury and Fortunus. And I think there's some real parallels to Moist Von Lipwig as well, especially with the endless wealth and the wishing hat. I will see if I can link the article legally. I got it through the folklore membership. What's it? Mm-hmm. I'll see if it's been published anywhere open source. But just a little extract from the piece. In the original Fortunatus, by the way, I've said that wrong the first time, never mind, text dating from 1509, there are many points of contact centered in the hat, such as its appearance, the themes of speed, secrecy, invisibility, theft, and commerce between Fortunatus and Mercury. So yeah, right?
Yeah.
I reckon. Yeah. We've got to see if we can find a decent translation to read. I came across this quite late in the day. Mm-hmm. I didn't go into it very far, but I love it. Also, I'm just going to say, I think the little focus on pigeons everywhere has nothing to do with gods, but I just want it's messenger based. I think it's a little nod to the fact that that pigeons should have more of a role in messenger stuff still.
Yeah.
I like to think Pratchett was a secret pigeon fancier. That's all. That's all.
Closet pigeon fancy approach. Are we bone this whole thing wide open?
Yep. I'm amazing. Adding that to my headcanon. He did a good job with the PR corporate nonsense, and he liked pigeons.
Yeah.
As a concept. So I expect you some of the magic-y bits there you might be able to pick up on in your talking point.
Yeah, a little bit. So the first thing I want to talk about, though, is save the cat.
Oh.
It's very important that Moist saves the cat to be a hero. So Save the Cat is the full title, Save the Cat, the last book on screenwriting you'll ever need. It's a very, very famous book on screenwriting.
Oh, I've never heard of it.
The phrase Save the Cat is kind of used as shorthand for, like, know your basics of screenwriting, your hero saves the cat. By Blake Snyder. The moment itself, Save the Cat, it's the decisive moment where a protagonist shows that they're worth rooting for.
Mm-hmm.
So Moist is doing this in a very self-aware way.
Huh.
If you are interested in screenwriting, it is a very interesting book. It has been criticized a lot for kind of leading to a lot of formulaic screenplays, because the book like outlines like beat by beat things that should happen in your screenplay, and that
I don't think the book should be criticized for that.
Yeah. Ben Aronovich actually dedicated Whispers Underground, which is book three of the Rivers of London books, to Blake Snyder.
Oh, cool.
For the Save the Cat thing.
And he dedicated another one to Terry Pratchett, didn't he?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, there's a just fun little link there. Bring it all full circle. So Moist is fully aware that, you know, being this avatar, doing what he's doing successfully, requires him being seen a certain way, and that includes saving the cat.
Yeah,
He needs people to keep believing in him, much like a Discworld god does.
Oh, yeah.
Because he is powerless without these people's belief.
Everything in a much more direct way. Yeah. Ooh.
So it's like a very self-aware use of a trope, which is something Pratchett does a lot, and I really love. And this whole book is very self-aware of the tropes it's using and plays with.
Yeah.
And I think it's fantastic. I love after the Save the Cat bit, you get the headline, Man Saves Cat.
Yeah.
And Vetinari's little...
Cat saves man.
But sometimes I think they're quite sad that they've only got one front page to put headlines on. And you get some other, like, self-aware tropey moments just in that bit, especially some horror moments when Moist realises Grial is behind him.
It's not only self-aware, but it's audience-aware, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's not just the author's aware, but he's telling us.
Yeah. And everyone, the audience gets to be in on the joke because the author tells you they're doing the joke, which could be so clunky if it was handled badly. Oh, yeah. But it's Terry Pratchett, so it's not clunky. It's great.
Nope. It's only clunky insofar as that weird six-dimensional machine is.
Yeah, obviously the sorting engine... I'm assuming at some point there was a clunk when Grial went in there. So yeah, you have this time slowed a little, senses heightened, there was a taste of copper in his mouth. And then after he kills Grial, if he'd been a hero, he would have taken the opportunity to say, that's what I call sorted. Since he wasn't a hero, he threw up.
Yes.
So my point is a combination of everything I've talked about with this book for the last couple of weeks. This book keeps engaging with this theme of hope and what it tells people, because people have hope because they believe in stories, because people read stories and they hope things that will come out the way they do in stories. I love the priesthood sort of settled for a kind of twinkly eyed denial that it could happen to anyone when it comes to the money, because now it's happened once, everyone's sort of like, oh, maybe if I pray, maybe I'll get taken to a secret cache of gold in the woods. And Moist recognized that kind of hope because it was how he'd made his living.
Yeah.
You know, that life generally hands you the sticky end of the stick, but this time you might be wrong. And this was known as the greatest of treasures, which is hope, which is a nice callback to the beginning of the book.
Yeah.
And Moist's hope that he can tunnel out of his cell.
Yes.
And there's a...
false hope as well as a theme, as a little underlying theme that Dearheart kicks out of him, of all people.
Yeah, he's struggling with the hopes that people are putting on him, these letters to the gods and what to do with these prayers to him. And, you know, he says something about not promising to deliver, and Adora's furiously says, you promised when you sold them the stamps.
Mm-hmm.
And then more calmly says, and it'll give them hope.
Yeah.
So you have these two sides to it. You have Moist kind of embracing hope and what it can do for people, and then you have Guilt, who gets away with things because people have hope.
Yeah.
And his perspective of hope is the curse of humanity.
Yeah.
And so if you look at what happens to Gilt at the end, not accepting the angel, because he doesn't hope. He thinks he can take care of things for himself, so he thinks he can walk out the door. He doesn't need the job at the Royal Mint.
Yeah.
Whereas Moist has always danced on the edge of hope, and so thinks to check before walking out of the door.
Yeah, and he says a little before, doesn't he? The fear being the hope turned inside out. You know it can't go wrong. You're sure it can't go wrong, but it might.
Yeah.
And yeah, so I guess, yeah, guilt never got that far along the hope spectrum.
Exactly. And then following on from what I was talking about with magic last week, your quote from earlier, so perfect, this idea of this happening is this physical, tangible magic of logarithms. No one explained those to me. They go with physics and golf.
No, they're magic. We just heard.
And the just slightly before that, what was magic but something that happened at the snap of a finger? Mm-hmm. Because magic is so normalised within the Discworld, it makes the stars stay up and feet stay down.
Yeah, yes.
It's not physics, it's magic. And it compares magic to magical.
Yes, yes.
So why people want to believe in Moist, and how this ties back into just the power of stories, because I haven't said that often enough on the podcast ever.
No, I don't think I've ever heard you put those words together. Interesting, tell me more.
Reacher sums it up quite nicely. People enjoy the experience of being fooled if it promises a certain amount of entertainment, which is certainly how it starts with Moist.
It's what fiction is.
Yeah. But his redemption starts, really, with not responding how Reacher did. Reacher opted to burn down the post office. Moist could have burned down the trunk and decided not to.
Yeah.
In a simpler story, he would slay the monster. But here he understands that the trunk is not the monster. The board is the monster. Guilt is the monster.
Yeah. He's looking, oh my God, it's like fucking Voyager the Dawn Treader when the dragon had a cuff around its leg, and that's why he was angry.
Yeah.
Sorry.
No, totally with you on that one. It just took me a second to remember what happened in footage of the Dawn Treader.
Everybody's first thought.
But that moment we talked about with
my Roman Empire. Sorry, Karen.
That moment we talked about with Ridcully, his opinion, which is all from hearsay and what a bloke said down the pub. He's heard the short version of the story, the trunk of the baddies and the post office is the plucky little underdog.
Underdog, I love that though.
And he buys into the story that he is being told that is not untrue, but that he is very much being told, and responds by nominating the book full of diagrams.
Yes.
Which is partly he's bought into the story and partly that Ridcully's a chaos gremlin.
Oh, yes.
Our brackets favorite. Affectionate.
Brackets, always affectionate.
And this comes to a head in how Moist kills the monster at the end, which is the power of the message he's sending from dead men. Because he knows the power of what words can do, just like Terry Pratchett.
What I found really interesting about that bit is he didn't script it for him shutting his eyes, lining up the thoughts and speaking.
Yeah. He didn't sit and write down beforehand what he was going to say. He'd read the evidence and he's clever and he could put the right facts in.
Do you think, having read A Life Worth Footnotes, do you think some of that is Pratchett writing? When he got into that zone, because I think Rob Wilkins a couple of times said that, like, yeah, he just fucking sat down and wrote that.
Yeah.
Like, brackets, slight disgust.
And also, like, because he would so often dictate.
Yeah.
And there's something about dictating and the way the ideas just come out really perfectly. I think it relates there. But Moist knows that although what he's doing is winning, he knows he is doing it in a... He knows what he's doing is dishonourable, that he shouldn't put words in the mouths of dead men, which I think is an interesting, not even really callback, but a relationship to Feet of Clay, where the golem tries to save the priest by putting words into the mouth of a dead man.
Oh, yeah. Ooh. Yeah.
Anyway, my point is, because there was one at the end of this
Underground. Didn't even need one, but go on.
This book is a story. The good guys win.
Fuck. Sorry.
Who fucking knew? This book is a very story-shaped story. The good guys win, the bad board comes down, and you can tell, just as we talked about right in the first episode, there is a palpable fury at corporate greed and nonsense that from Pratchett. So he writes a story where it doesn't prevail. He can't physically go and take down BT with a woodpecker, but he can tell a really fucking good story and send a damning message with it. Mm. I think it's beautiful.
I do. Yeah. Ray Bradbury wrote about that, wrote about how you should choose something you're angry about and sit down and write about that. That's one of his 10 in the art of writing. I mean, fuck, if you're as good as Terry Pratchett as that, you got to take down like the whole world.
Have you got an obscure reference for Neil for me?
I have.
You sound quite sad about
sorry.
That.
Sorry, yes, I have. I didn't want to leave the story, but we will. Because I have to get this fucking podcast out.
The nice thing about...
Mainly.
The nice thing about how much we deeply love this book, though, is that we can talk about it a little bit more in December when we talk about the TV show.
Oh, that's a good point. Yeah, nice. All right, so The Woodpecker. As you mentioned, one of our listeners in Discord, actually, I've completely forgotten who it was because it was several weeks ago now, mentioned that the woodpecker was probably, well, definitely a reference to the Russian woodpecker. And now that is a reference to the 70s and 80s when a strange noise could be heard on shortwave radios all around the globe. It was very powerful. And it was immediately noticed by professional radio operators and by amateurs. And it turned out to be the Duga radio. The Duga radar, a critical part of the Soviet Union's early warning system. And that was to detect incoming missiles, basically. But it was just incredibly strong. And it turned out that the antenna was absolutely huge. It was 700 meters long, 700 meters long and 150 Jesus. Meters high. And so despite that size, the Soviets built two. One was near Chernobyl, and that was Duga 1, and the other was in Siberia, called Duga 2. However, I reckon this, like their whole plan was also a reference to this kind of almost urban legend from early days of hacking. I saw someone mention this on Reddit, and I very much agree. So I'm going to read out bits of this and kind of link the... It's not even an article. I don't even know what this fucking website is. But this is the best way to pick up internet lore, in my opinion. Just random HTML, like basic HTML websites. So, once upon a time, most hackers knew about the infamous IBM Black Team. In case you don't, I suggest you go and read about them first before you carry on here. And I'll link to the link they link to.
Yeah.
Because it's very cool. And it's basically people who found the stuff wrong with code. penetration testers, you know. Early ones, yeah. Those. So let me tell you a story involving a member of the Black Team. This has come to me 13th hand, so I can't vouch for its veracity, but I can believe it. Oh, yes, I can believe it. And doesn't that sound a bit Pratchett-y?
Oh, so yeah.
I was drawn in here. There was a programmer at IBM who was terribly excited to get the job writing the driver interface software for a brand spanking new tape drive. This was one of those cabinet-sized machines you'd see in like the 60s and 70s movies kind of thing.
Yeah.
So it was reel-to-reel tape. You could fast-forward it, rewind it, stop-start, whatever. Almost hypnotic. Maybe I should write a simulator as a screensaver. Yes, maybe you should, random person. Anyway, our programmer was very excited by the idea of writing the software for this new piece of hardware, but also a little anxious. After all, his work would attract the attention of the Black Team, something no programmer ever really wanted. It sounds very much like they're the dark clerks turning up to audit you, like the way they're talked about. So he decided to thwart them by writing his code perfectly. So perfect, so neat that nothing wrong could be found with it. And the Black Team looked at it and they couldn't find anything, and that pissed them off. and so they came back. The entire team eventually was looking at his code to find the bugs that they just knew must be there, but they couldn't find it. And so the programmer was happy, content, confident, and above all, smug. So the day came. The hardware was going to be unveiled and demonstrated to the world. This sort of event was always a big one. New hardware was a big deal and duly trumpeted. At the last minute before the demonstration began, a member of the Black Team hurried up to the console and began frantically typing in commands. Our programmer was confident. He knew the code was perfect. It was proven and tested. Nothing could go wrong. He wasn't even perturbed when the tape started spinning at full speed and running right to the end. It stopped before the end, as he knew he would. It was safe. It was working. It was perfect. It started to rewind and the same thing happened. Stop before the end. This kept happening. Ran all the way to the end, all the way to the start, again and again, with intolerances. The black team were beaten, so the programmer thought, and then he saw it. The cabinet had started to build up a gentle rocking motion. Ah, which was growing. What could be happening? And so the black team had found the fundamental frequency at which the cabinet would rock and programmed the tape to resonate. And in mounting horror, the programmer watched the cabinet at first subtly and then quite violently began rocking violently until it finally fell over in front of the whole world press.
Amazing.
History doesn't relate what happened to the programmer or to the product, despite the tale being utterly believable. I've been able to find no record of it. The greybeard who told me the story has moved on to a place where I can no longer ask questions, and so I'm left with what might just be a tall tale. What a fucking folktale, for a start.
Amazing.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah.
A weird fucking urban legend folktale about 60s, 70s programming. And also, yeah. Shot that something like that's good. The walking cabinet thing is kind of a known phenomenon with that kind of computer thing. Like, if you're fucked up, you start the rocking momentum, whatever. But that is like a specific, like, deliberate thing. I do wonder if Pratchett had heard that urban legend and,
yeah,
and liked it.
Inspired some of the woodpecker.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Or as far as I know, woodpeckers fell trees by vibrating them. I don't know anything about ornithology.
I saw a bird once.
Yeah. Nice.
A pigeon.
Half a pigeon.
Right, okay, God.
Yeah, all right, let's go.
I think that's everything that we are going to say about the book Going Postal until, as I said, around Hogswatch, we will be revisiting with the TV adaptation of Going Postal, so that's plenty of heads up to acquire a DVD or watch it however you like.
Yep. And if you've got any complaints about the bits we left out, mispronounced, or whatever, then get them in and we'll read about it. Hogswatch, maybe, if we remember.
We might. So we'll be taking a week off. We'll be back on the 9th of October with part one of Thud.
Ah!
Excited to get to Thud. However, keep an eye on the feed between now and then, because there's a might be a cheeky little bonus something coming your way.
Oh, maybe. Maybe a little
cheeky
bonus.
Cheeky little bonus something. However, until in the meantime, dear listener, you can join our Discord. If I remember, there'll be a link down below. You can follow us on Instagram at The True Show Make You Fret, on Twitter at Make You Fret Pod, on Blue Sky at Make You Fret Pod, on Facebook at The True Show Make You Fret. You can join our subreddit community, r/TTSMYF. You can send us your thoughts, queries, castle snacks, explanations of up needles all, and no dog turds. Thank you. The True Show Make You Fret Pod at gmail.com. If you want to support this bollocks financially, you can go to patreon.com/ The True Show Make You Fret, and you can exchange your hard-earned pennies for all sorts of bonus nonsense.
You can.
And until next time, dear listener, I'm on the wrong page.
Fantastic.
Fucking sworn
it's the last page.
Until next time, dear listener, sadly, he did not believe in angels.
That's a nice ending.
It is a nice ending.
So episode title, story-shaped story?
Yep, perfect.
All right, nice. I think we, I know it's run a bit long, but I think we did well considering. What a fucking book. What a fucking book. I'd talk about that forever.
I could quite happily, but that's going to be great.
It is.